v. Cook. On behalf of the appellant, Samantha Cook, Genevieve Swinford will argue. On behalf of the state of Idaho, Theodore Tollefson. Are there any preliminary matters? You may proceed, ma'am.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. This case presents two questions to this court today. First, what is the meaning of the phrase readily legible in a temporary permit statute? Second, depending on this court's interpretation, is that statute governing temporary permits void for vagueness as applied to the appellant Ms. Cook's conduct? For the benefits of the students today, I'd like to briefly go through the facts of this traffic stop for the court. Officer Jacobson observed Ms. Cook driving with no front or rear license plate. He pulled up behind her and initiated the traffic stop. Upon pulling her over, he saw that there was a piece of paper in her rear windshield. He could tell that it was a temporary permit. However, because it had been raining that day, it was around midnight, the roadway was wet, and there may have also been a slight drizzle at the time, he couldn't make out the text of the permit without wiping the condensation off the exterior of her car. Once he did that, however, he could read it, and it was a valid permit. Instead of Officer Jacobson terminating the encounter, once he saw that permit, he continued the seizure, asked Ms. Cook questions. Eventually, she went out of the car. He searched it, and he found contraband. Ms. Cook moved to suppress all of that evidence obtained from the start of the initial unlawful seizure. The district court, although it was reluctant to do so, denied Ms. Cook's motion to suppress. The district court found it especially troubling that Idaho citizens who would otherwise be in full compliance with the statute would then suddenly, due to an act of nature, be violating this traffic law and be subject to a seizure. But the district court was bound by the Court of Appeals' interpretation of readily legible in Kinch, and thus it denied her motion. This court has not interpreted what that phrase readily legible means. We would ask that this court reject the Court of Appeals' broad interpretation of the statute, which adds additional and different language. So what does this phrase readily legible mean?
Did you appeal under the state and the federal constitution?
No, Your Honor, just the Fourth Amendment.
And so how do you differentiate Rodriguez?
Rodriguez, I think, applies here, Your Honor. Upon the officer seeing that permit in her rear windshield, even though he couldn't make out the text, at that point she had complied with the statute. He had to go up to the window, say, "I'm sorry, I pulled you over. I didn't think you had a permit or a license. Now I see that, and you're free to go."
And at that point in time, wouldn't he have smelled the marijuana in the car?
We don't know, Your Honor. The state had to present sufficient evidence of that, and it didn't pursue that alternative theory.
When you say that, do you mean the smell or the fact that he went up to the window?
The smell. We don't know when he smelled the marijuana. It could have been within the first minute. It could have been a few minutes later. And since the state didn't offer that evidence and didn't argue that as a separate exception, based on our interpretation of readily legible, at that moment he saw that he had to end the encounter. And we're not saying that he couldn't do anything at all, that she had to guess that, "Oh, he's not coming up to the car. I'm free to leave." He can still go up and say, "I pulled you over. I didn't see it. Now I do. You can go." We don't know when he smelled that odor. I recognize...
Oh. By saying that, you've said he has the right to seize the car, say, "I made a mistake," and leave. But if he smells marijuana at that time, he has further reason to prolong the stop, does he not?
Yes, he could have. But we don't have that evidence here. We don't know when he smelled that marijuana. There could be a situation where when the officer goes up to the window, they see bottles of alcohol, they smell the odor, see bloodshot eyes, and now they have another reason to detain the person, a separate basis of reasonable suspicion and probable cause to search the car and seize the driver.
Okay.
We don't have that here. So readily legible means capable of being read without much difficulty or hesitation. And I get that by putting the two terms together. Readily means with ease, without much difficulty. Legible means capable of being read or capable of being discovered or interpreted by known markings and indications. So what we're looking at are the contents and the condition of the document itself. And I think it's helpful to use some examples to distinguish what legible means versus readable or visible.
Does it make any difference that it needs to be legible while the vehicle's being operated on the highway as opposed to when you get right up next to it and you can clearly then read it? But when you're operating down the way of the highway, legible from that distance might be something totally different than what the dictionary might say it is when you have a legible holographic will before you. You get my point here? It's that it's legible while you're on the roadway, not while you're sitting at a desk or looking through the windshield close up.
Yes, and so I have two answers for you on that, Your Honor. First, I think the operating on highway part of the statute refers to that you have to display it while you're driving. So an individual could keep it in their glove box, theoretically, until they get out on the road. Then they need to tape it to their rear windshield. And the second part of what readily legible means is I don't think it has anything to do with whether the person can read it from a distance or that it's visible. I think that's something different. And I think some examples sort of illustrate what I mean by readily legible. So I've put readily legible when someone is in violation of the statute in sort of two different camps. The first would be what I call DMV error. If the DMV decides that they're going to start writing these temporary permits in cursive or hieroglyphics, something where it is not capable of easily being read, that's a violation of the statute. On the other hand, if the other side, driver error, if a driver spills coffee on their permit and so the ink is all smudged, their child colors all over it, they crumple it up in a ball, and they put it on their rear windshield, they're also violating the statute. In both of those cases, the four corners of the document have been altered in a way that it's not capable of being read without much difficulty or hesitation.
What if you have a vehicle that has the tinting on the windows that's in violation of the tint allowed, and the officer suspects that? That's a whole other question, but he can't even see this, or if he can't even barely make out a document, but it's so tinted, he doesn't know if it's there or not, so he stops him.
That may be in violation of the other portion of the statute that requires it to be displayed, and that gets to my example about snow on the car. But I don't think that that's a violation of the readily legible portion of the statute. If the permit is still properly written in, Times New Roman, large font, it hasn't been bent or crumpled in any way, it's still capable of being read without much difficulty. And so that brings me to my example of snow. If there is a sheet of ice or snow covering the rear windshield, so the permit cannot be seen, it is still readily legible and it's not violating that portion of the statute, as long as we have evidence that shows that otherwise the permit was proper.
Ms. Winford, I'm glad to know that your position isn't based totally on the penmanship used on the permit, but concerning your statement you just made about snow and water, doesn't the driver of the vehicle have a responsibility? Let's say we're talking about a license plate, not a temporary permit. Don't they have to keep the snow off the license plate? Don't they have to keep the snow off the window? And if the condensation similarly blocks view, why would it be any different just because it's frozen water?
They do have that obligation with the license plate, and the license plate statute has additional requirements beyond readily legible. It actually doesn't use that language. A license plate statute requires multiple things to be clearly visible.
No obstructions.
Maintained from free foreign materials, in a condition to be clearly legible, and most importantly, it says must be readable from a distance of 75 feet during daylight. So that says if it's daylight outside, I have to be 75 feet away and be able to read that license plate. So even if it's snowing, but it's daylight, the driver would still be in violation of the statute if snow was covering it. There isn't any visibility or readability requirement with temporary permits, and although we're arguing this is a plain language interpretation, I would submit to the court that that makes sense. A temporary permit is a piece of paper you get from the DMV, you get from the dealer. It's in your car for not a long period of time. It's on your windshield where there are going to be other factors in play, and it may not always be perfect driving conditions. A license plate is much more permanent. It's how we identify drivers on the road every day. So it's important that a license plate has all those additional requirements. You have to be able to read it. It has to be visible. No foreign materials, and also clearly legible. But with a temporary permit, it's not as high of a burden. It just has to be readily legible, which means that it is within the four corners, written in a way that's capable of being understood.
But doesn't the language prominent place, that is, that it has to be displayed in a prominent place, indicate that the statute requires something more than just it's capable of being read if you're standing on top of the document?
Yes, it has to also be put in that prominent place. And so there could be cases where, like the snow, for example, that the permit would not be in violation of the readily legible element, but it would be in violation of the prominent place element. So if someone leaves their permit in their glove box and is driving around, they're violating the display and prominent place part of that statute. So an officer could pull them over, even if they showed them their permit and said, hey, I have a valid permit. It wasn't displayed properly in that prominent place. But the permit itself was still readily legible because it wasn't tampered or altered with in any way that would make it so someone could not look at it and easily read it.
Well, but the idea being if you put the piece of paper on the side, for example, on a side window, one would arguably, I mean, you're not a typical police officer is going to be in less of a position to view that display versus if it's in the back window, right?
Right, and so that may not be a violation. I think that depends on the part of the language in the statute that you post on the windshield or in another prominent place. So maybe in another case before this court, we'll be litigating what a prominent place is. But there wasn't any question here that Ms. Cook did put her permit in the appropriate place. The district court found this was a valid permit, it was posted in the right area, and that the only reason the officer couldn't immediately read it is because of the rainwater on the exterior of her car.
So Ms. Winford, I tried to find the temporary permit in the record and couldn't find that. And it's been a long time since I've had a temporary permit in my window because I have old license plates for one thing. But one of my recollections is that the temporary permit is a document you get from the Department of Motor Vehicles, and that I don't remember putting anything on my temporary permit. I thought it was all supplied by the Department of Motor Vehicles. Is that correct?
I'm not entirely sure, Your Honor. I think there are situations where perhaps a dealer, if you buy a car, could give you a temporary permit, mm-hmm. and they would write the date on it. But I recognize that the statute is kind of unusual. If the DMV decides for some reason they're going to start doing 8-point font and wingdings for the font, the driver is liable under the statute. So it is slightly an absurd result that the DMV could cause a driver to be in violation of the statute. But even when there's an absurd result, this court has to construe the language as written when it's clear and plain and unambiguous. So it is almost strict liability in the sense that the DMV could hand a driver a permit and they could be in violation of the statute. And I'd hope that that's something that could get
resolved. The Court of Appeals has indicated readily legible has nothing to do with anything other than the form that is given to you by the Department of Transportation. And that is that it must be legible a car length away. And quite frankly, that form is almost impossible to read a car length away. So was there any testimony as concerns that the form and substance of same is an impossibility under the Court of Appeals ruling?
There wasn't any testimony as to if it would have been impossible in all cases, that there is a certain distance. And the Court of Appeals and Kinch recognized we don't have to set the distance, but it's going to have to be some car lengths away that, you know, at some certain point the officer's going to be able to see it, and we're not going to set that. And I think that's the problem with this statute, is that you can't really set a distance because these are very difficult to read. And so that's why the requirement is only that it be readily legible, that we want these to be capable of being understood, but it doesn't have to be from a certain distance like a license plate. To go back to your question, Justice Stegner, there isn't the temporary permit in the record, but if this court views the dash cam video, you can see her permit clearly in the rear windshield. So if you view the video, I think it's States Exhibit 1, you can see that permit taped up there. And when the officer initially walks up to the car, he sort of looks at it for a second, then goes talks to her, then gets her information, asks her questions, and then when he's going back, he wipes off the condensation and can tell at that point that it's valid. So the court could view that to see what her temporary permit looked like. And again, the district court found here it was valid. There weren't any questions about was it crumpled up, was it bent, did she put it upside down, was there coffee spilled on it, did she scribble all over it. It was completely valid, and the district court reluctantly denied the motion because of the Kinch decision.
But do you know what was behind the strategic decision not to enter the permit into the record? It would seem to me that would be a lot easier question for this court if we could actually see what the permit looked like in its unadulterated state, not behind a wet window. I don't want to sound like Justice Potter Stewart, but I think I can know legibility when I see it, if you know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
It's an inside appellate joke.
There's so much to
Don't worry,
to.
There are very few of them, so you better laugh now.
Yeah. I think part of the reason why, I don't know why defense counsel didn't put it into the record. I don't think they need to. They can show the burden of there's been an initial seizure here without a warrant, and the state has to justify it. But it was clear that the district court found that this permit was completely valid and legible in all other sense, but for the rain.
Well, let me be clear. I'm not suggesting necessarily the defense should have put it in the record. It would just seem to me that would have been a nice thing for us to be able to look at in this case.
It may have been, Your Honor. And you can sort of see it from the dash cam video, and my still shot is actually a little more blurry than when you actually watch it. It's a little more clear, and you can see the permit there. We don't have it, but again, there is no dispute that it was written in a way where you could, there was some challenge to deciphering it. I want to briefly talk about the void for vagueness argument. If this court adopts a different interpretation than what we're advocating for today, if it agrees with the Court of Appeals reasoning, I think that the statute is then void for vagueness as applied to Ms. Cook's conduct. A statute is vague for two reasons. If it fails to give adequate notice of ordinary people with what conduct is prescribed, or if it invites arbitrary and discriminatory law enforcement. This statute, with a broad interpretation, does both. It doesn't give notice, and it allows the police unbridled discretion to enforce this law.
You've talked a lot about the word may in your briefing.
Yes.
Is that applicable to this argument as well?
Yes, I think it's significant for the interpretation and for the void for vagueness argument.
So let me touch on that, because I wanted to make sure we covered that. If we were to interpret the word may as meaning one thing all the time, I would certainly agree with your analysis, but as may could mean different things depending on the context that's used. If we interpret it the way that you do, wouldn't that render the statute as merely a suggestion or a guideline? And why should we assume that the legislature was passing suggestions and guidelines?
I don't think it's a guideline, Your Honor. I think it recognizes that things are not always going to be immediately readable and visible. So may be readily legible, recognizes that when there's snow, when there's glare, when there's fog, it may not be immediately readable.
Wouldn't the fairest, most reasonable interpretation of the word may there to be can be?
Right, right. And so it indicates where the individual needs to put the permit, and then also that this permit itself needs to be unaltered and in a way that's capable of being read. So I think that supports our interpretation.
So if we interpret it that way, though, is it still void for vagueness?
No. No, it's not. It's only void for vagueness if the court adopts the broader interpretation that readable also or legible also means visible from a certain distance or readable from a certain distance, that it includes all of those additional elements like the Court of Appeals interpretation.
Thank you for that clarification.
And your assertion is the video is in the record.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
States Exhibit 1.
Very good. Thank you.
In terms of the form of the permit, did it in fact comply with Transportation Board rules?
As far as I know, yes. The district court didn't make a finding that it was invalid.
What are the Transportation Board rules for the temporary permit? I know you talked about a 12-point font, no windings, but yeah. What is it?
I tried to look those up, Your Honor, looking at the DMV website and the Board of Transportation. I couldn't find those administrative rules, though, so I apologize that I don't have those.
No, I couldn't find them either.
Yeah, I Googled it. I tried. So I don't know, but at least in this case, it was valid based on the district court's finding. I don't have enough time to talk about void for vagueness, but I think the statute doesn't give adequate notice that people of ordinary intelligence would be in violation of the statute simply because of a changing weather condition. Between one day to the next, or 1 hour to the next, or even depending on the direction that someone is driving, all of a sudden they're in violation of the statute. The same with police officer. It gives them discretion to wait until there's less than optimal driving conditions and then pull someone over for committing this law when just a few days earlier when they were driving down the same road, they were complying with the statute. So I think there is a serious void for vagueness issue with the statute if the court adopts a more broad interpretation.
So if you were in private practice and Ms. Cook was your client, your advice to her because of her nefarious attitude towards controlled substance would be to get a license plate immediately, wouldn't it?
Yeah, she should probably do that. But it was her permit was valid at the time.
I understand that. I understand that.
She should probably do that. So we'd ask that this court reverse the district court's order and remand this case. Thank you.
Sir.
May it please the court, counsel. I think it's important to first look at what the standard we're looking at here in this case, and that is, first off, did Deputy Jacobson have reasonable, articulable suspicion to pull over Ms. Cook's car? Counsel for the appellant went through some of the facts, so I won't reiterate them in its entirety, but it's undisputed, and the district court found that at the time that Deputy Jacobson initiated the traffic stop, he had observed that Ms. Cook's car had no license plates, and he could not even see the temporary permit. The district court found, this is on page 54 of the record, or excuse me, the transcript, the court finds the following fact, that the deputy did not see the temporary registration on the white Honda Accord until he came up on the vehicle after putting on his emergency lights. And Exhibit 1, which was the Deputy Jacobson's dashboard cam, supports this finding. What you can see him turning around, or not turning around, he's already turned around, he's following, coming up behind Ms. Cook's car, and at that time, before his lights are on and before he's right up next to her, you can't even see the window, the permit in the back window. It's only after his lights are on, she's pulling over, and he's also pulling over with her that you can see it in the video. And that comports with Deputy Jacobson's testimony, which was he did not even see this piece of paper until he had started the traffic stop and had pulled him over. I believe it was Justice Mueller's questions regarding why was some things were in the record and some things were not. And I think it's important to look at how this case was presented to the district court. Ms. Cook filed a motion to suppress on two bases. Let me back up a second. Deputy Jacobson articulated two reasons why he stopped Ms. Cook. One, that he did not see license plates or a temporary registration permit, and two, that she touched or briefly went over the fog line. Below, the district court, the defense argued that under this court's ruling in Neal, and based upon some of the lacks of facts, that there was no reasonable suspicion to believe that she had violated the law by crossing the fog line. And two, the defense argued under the Court of Appeals decision in Soloy, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, that the existence of a temporary permit by itself essentially invalidates the reason for the stop, that there's no longer reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop. So the whole, as this was postured below, those were the two issues. And the issue then evolved into whether or not the permit itself was readable because of the condensation and the fog on the back window. And I'd also point out that the evidence in this case supports the Deputy Jacobson's and the district court's findings that it was obscured. If you look at the video, the back window is heavily condensed, and there's fog and water, I don't know exactly the technical term, on the back window. So I think that kind of addresses why some things are in the record and some things are not in the record. So here in this case, and it appears now that Ms. Cook is, or the appellant is conceding that as soon as he sees the temporary permit, he can still go, Deputy Jacobson can still go up and speak to Ms. Cook. And that seems to be a slightly different position than they took below and in their initial briefing, but I'll leave that to this court to determine if that's the case or not. But if that's the position, then we believe that the district court was correct in denying the motion to suppress, because as Deputy...
Well, there's nothing in the record that says when did he smell the dope that allowed him to prolong this other than to say, thank you have the registration, therefore have a nice evening.
You are correct, Your Honor. In the motion to suppress, that was not brought up, and I think that was brought up for the reasons I articulated below. What the issues were that were brought from the district court was, one, the fog line Neal issue, and two, the readily legible.
It was 12:18 a.m.
Yes, it was 12:18 a.m. That is true. But
you're saying that the issue of prolonging the stop unnecessarily was not raised below.
Correct, and that's how I read both the arguments of counsel at the suppression hearing and their motion to suppress. In the officer, and this is where I would point to the record regarding when he smelled the marijuana. While it's not motion to suppress, Deputy Jacobson did submit a probable cause affidavit. In the probable cause affidavit, he articulates that when he made initial contact, that's when he smelled the marijuana, and then proceeds to go through his steps of the stop from that point on.
And that's presumably under oath, correct?
I believe it is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the administration, sometimes they don't make it into the record under oath, but I believe this one is.
We will double check.
As I am. So if that is the case, then I think under Justice Burdick's questioning, that is perfectly admissible under Rodriguez in the United States Supreme Court opinion. The officer can, after effectuating a reasonable stop, which he did at this point in time, he didn't see a license plate or a temporary permit, he can still go ask the questions that are typically associated with a traffic stop. He can ask for driver's license, insurance, and those related questions. He can't just then extend the stop beyond the initial reasons. And in this case, on the video, there actually was an issue with Ms. Cook's insurance, and there's a back and forth regarding she had recently got an insurance ticket, and so that's one of the reasons why he talked to her for a few minutes.
She didn't have insurance, did she?
She did not. She had actually just recently received a infraction ticket for insurance, and Deputy Jacobson then talks to her of the importance of having insurance and if she gets a second one, it will be a misdemeanor. And then they talk about why she doesn't have it, and she has a job. In fact, waiting that she's on disability. This is beyond the scope of, I imagine, but yes, Your Honor, you're absolutely correct.
But isn't the test always for reasonable suspicion based on totality of circumstances known to the officer at or before the time of the stop?
That's correct.
So all that happened once he gets out of the car, is that even relevant to the reasonable articulable suspicion inquiry?
I don't believe it is. I think as soon as he effectuates the stop and she starts to submit to that authority, that's the point that this court looks at whether or not the officer had reasonable articulable suspicion.
But then how do we square that with Saloy? On a bright sunny day, there's no rain obstructing it, but what in any officer could legibly tell what that's saying when he's driving down the road from some distance away? Doesn't he stop everybody and give him the license to stop everyone?
And well, in Saloy, it's interesting, Your Honor. There was evidence presented by one of the officers who said he saw a temporary permit, and he just stopped to check it out because he had no reason to believe that it was invalid, and he stopped them anyway. And in that case, I believe the district court granted the motion to suppress and saying that's not right. The state appealed, and the court of appeals agreed with the district court and said, yeah, you can't just stop someone just because they have a temporary permit. And that was the evidence in Saloy. And I think the court of appeals in Saloy eventually held was unless there is, and I don't want to slaughter the exact language, but unless there's a reason to believe that the temporary permit is invalid, there's no reason for the stop. In this case, the deputy saw no temporary permit. So we don't even need to get to the readability question. He had reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop because there's no license plate and there's no temporary permit. That's what the district court found, and that's what the video evidence supports. Did that answer your question?
You did.
Great. So, moving on, I think at this point in time, moving on to the void for vagueness question, unless there's any issues on reasonable suspicion. Appellant argues that it is void for vagueness because it doesn't give notice to those who are subject to it, and it gives the officer, doesn't contain sufficient guidelines and makes gives the officers unbridled discretion to pull people over. The state would disagree with that argument. The statute does give notice to ordinary people that they must place these temporary permits, which is a form issued by the DM or by the board, and it must be displayed at all times while the vehicle is being operated on the highway. It must be placed upon a windshield or another prominent place where it may be readily legible. It has to be readable while they're driving.
Okay, so the statute says a temporary permit shall be in a form.
Correct.
And issued under rules adopted by the board. So what are the rules that the Transportation Board has issued that govern the form of this document?
And that's not in the record, Your Honor. And that would
Yeah, but that's a legal question, isn't it? I mean, I ought to be able I ought not have to look at the record to figure out what the rules issued by the Transportation Board are.
I don't know what the rules are issued by the Transportation Board, Your Honor.
Are there any?
I believe there are, but I don't know.
Seem to be awfully hard to find.
Yes, but I believe below everyone conceded or agreed that the form in which it was presented, the actual document itself, was complied with these rules, or if it was not raised below, if it somehow did not with the form.
Well, I'm just interested because if we're talking about void for vagueness, I mean, I'd like to know what the rules are.
I think that's a fair question, Your Honor. And I would just argue that what how the case has developed since for the district court is whether or not it's at what point it becomes readable or legible that I think it becomes the argument. And below, there was no evidence presented regarding distances or anything at this point. The evidence presented was officer couldn't even read it until he was right on top of it and actually had to wipe it off, which again, you can see on the video, that's exactly what he does.
Now, I recognize that the Fourth Amendment issue versus the way that the statute reads, those are two very separate inquiries.
But it is a fair question, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Tolleson,
yes, sir.
As I read Kinch, they never got to the question of at what distance it had to be readily legible.
Correct.
Strikes me that there are two reasonable interpretations of the statute. One is that it has to be readily legible from a car following, mm-hmm. or readily legible when you're up close and reading it. And doesn't the principle of lenity, which would apply or seemingly apply, would mean that it would be more lenient to say that it must be readily legible upon closer examination as opposed to from some distance?
And yes, Your Honor, it would be more lenient to read it. It has to be only read up close. However, I think the language of subsection 4 would dictate against that ruling, against it having to be read up close, because the subsection 4 requires that it must be displayed at all times while the vehicle is being operated on the highways.
That's talking about displaying, though. That doesn't talk about readily legible. Then it goes on to say where it may be readily legible.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think you have to read the whole thing. I would argue that you have to read the whole thing in context, that it has to be placed while you're operating, has to be placed in a prominent place where it may be readily legible while you're operating it on the highways. I think that the first clause, while you're being operated on the highways, everything flows from that.
But if the board is the entity that determines what it should consist of, isn't that the board's determination, and that has nothing to do with what the person driving the car decides what should be on the form?
So if I understand your question, Your Honor, is it should the board issue regulations dictating how far away that must be readily legible? Is that?
Well, if it seems to me that if the board is the entity that is responsible for determining what the permit says and how it's displayed, that it really is nonsensical to suggest that the citizen has any responsibility over the distance at which it should be readily legible.
I would respond to that by saying that the citizen has an obligation to be placing it in a place where it may be readily legible, which would include not placing it behind any obstruction. So not put it behind like a bumper sticker, or put it behind a speaker, or put something in the back, or put a blanket in front of it, or in this case, putting it behind snow or condensation. I would say that becomes in the driver's obligation. If something is not readily legible, if it is obstructed by some external or internal factor.
Well, let's explore the policy behind all this. And why does the legislature require vehicles to have license plates or temporary permits? Why do we do that?
Well. And I believe Deputy Jacobson testified to some of this in the record, that it's so we can identify who is driving the car, who the car belongs to, if there's any issues regarding stolen vehicles or anything along those nature. So the whole concept is that we want to be able to make sure that vehicle is properly licensed and registered.
So it's an investigative tool for law enforcement to determine ownership of vehicles?
I would say without
having to stop the vehicle and ask somebody about it.
I would say that's part of it. I would say a multitude of factors go into it in addition to law enforcement investigation. You could also consider community caretaking functions and other factors.
So although we have two separate statutes, one for license plates and one for temporary permits, is the policy objective the same?
I would say so.
They're the functional equivalent of each other.
Yes, they are similar.
Okay.
So we believe that the statute is not void for vagueness because it gives give notice to those who are subject to it. So onto the second issue, whether or not the ordinance contains guidelines and imposes sufficient discretion on those who must enforce the ordinance. And here we also believe that it does. Like any other traffic violation, if the officer can't see the permit or can't read the permit, then they're potentially in violation of the statute. That is enough guidelines that this would apply to license plates or any other issue. So we don't believe this statute is void for vagueness. And unless there are any questions? Okay, I thought there might have been one.
Let me, feeding off of Justice Mueller's comment, if it is for vehicle identification, i.e., is this car stolen, why wouldn't a police officer, contrary to Solis, be able to see a registration, stop you, and then inquire as to the ownership of the automobile?
Well,
i.e., are you the owner of this automobile?
Well, they would be able to, if they're able to read, again, they're able to read what's on the temporary permit.
What I'm getting to is they could stop anybody at any time.
They can. Well, that would potentially violate the Fourth Amendment. They've got to have a reasonable articulable suspicion for the stop.
What if the reason for the statute is, I want to make sure this car is not stolen?
They have to have reason, and if they can read the temporary permit or the license plate, and they can run it through the system, and it comes back reported stolen, then at that point in time, yes, they could pull over the car.
Thank you.
Unless there are any further questions.
That's a pretty dumb one.
I would never say that, Your Honor.
I can.
Unless there are further questions, the state would ask that this court affirm the judgment of the district court.
Thank you, sir. How much time does the appellant have? Very well, ma'am.
Thank you. I want to briefly address two points. First, Justice Steiner, your question about the rule of lenity. My understanding of this court's rules of statutory construction are that if a statute is ambiguous, then the court can turn to the rule of lenity. And then I think this court could also consider how a different construction of the statute could make it void for vagueness. If the statute is just plain, using an unambiguous statute, it just has to go off of the plain words. If it's ambiguous, then it can look to the rule of lenity, and I would argue under the rule of lenity, and what I've pointed out about the statute being void for vagueness, it would have to, again, go under the more narrow interpretation of readily legible being the contents and the condition of the document itself and nothing else. And then I also want to really talk about whether the stop was prolonged. Ms. Cook argued from the beginning that the officer didn't have reasonable suspicion for this traffic stop, either based on the fog line issue or the permit. That was her position all along. If the state wanted to argue in the alternative, okay, even if there wasn't reasonable suspicion, once he got to the car, he smelled marijuana, he saw alcohol, that's a separate justification for the stop, and the state would have had to present that below. I don't have the police report printed out on the record here today, but I can tell the court that on page 66 of the state's memo in opposition to defendant's motion, the state argues, during the initial encounter with Ms. Cook, Deputy Jacobson detected the odor of marijuana coming from the vehicle. There is no indication about when during that initial contact. The initial contact wasn't 30 seconds. It was longer than that. Ms. Cook states, with regard to the odor, Deputy Jacobson then contacted the driver, Ms. Cook, who he believed appeared to be nervous, and he also believed he smelled the odor of marijuana. Again, we don't know when he smelled that odor. If the state wanted to argue that the moment he walked up to the car, he was confronted with the smell of marijuana, the state would have had presented that below and should have asked the deputy questions about that. There is no testimony from the deputy about when he smelled marijuana, and then naturally no findings by the district court on that.
What if it was extended because of the lack of insurance?
Then we might have a different situation, Your Honor, but I don't know how that would happen with what the officer should have done. He shouldn't have conducted any inquiry because he no longer had a reasonable suspicion to detain her.
I'm going off of the Attorney General's interpretation of the record, and he suggested that he was basically educating her about the purposes of the insurance statute and why it's important to have insurance. Is that a legitimate function for extending a stop?
No, I don't think so, Your Honor, because the officer wouldn't have had that information if he wouldn't have continued to talk to her. So I don't think he learned that right away. First, he asked her a few other questions, where are you going, and can I have your ID, things like that. So he wouldn't have learned that until later. I don't think an officer can stop people just because they want to educate them about
the rules of the road. I agree, but once the windows roll down, isn't the very first question, can I see your license and registration and proof of insurance? Isn't that typically how these conversations, that's pretty much the pickup line that happens in all these conversations?
That's typically what happens when the officer has reasonable suspicion that, a traffic violation has occurred and they want to then cite the person for it. But if that hasn't happened, I don't think an officer can just walk up to someone and ask for their ID, just like they couldn't walk up to you on the street if you weren't violating any law and say, hey, let me see your license, where are you going, what's going on. If they had reasonable suspicion, they could do that. But when that reasonable suspicion is completely dispelled, I think all the officer can say is, I pulled you over because you didn't have this. You know, I'm sorry, you're free to go. I mean, I suppose the officer could not do anything and just drive off and leave the driver wondering what just happened. But we recognize that, you know, generally the Fourth Amendment is, you know, the touchstone is reasonableness. So I don't know if we can make an argument that the officer couldn't at least say, you are no longer seized. And I don't think that they could do any more under that situation.
I understand.
Thank you.
Thank you. Matter's now under advisement. We'll render a decision. Yeah, we'll shake hands and go this way. Going this way. Okay, as usual, I'm backwards. Thank you.